Welcome to the James River Church Podcast. You're about to hear another inspirational message from Pastor John Lindell. It's our prayer that this message is an encouragement and blessing to your life.
Well, good morning, and so good to have you here at James River Church. Thank you. I realize there's a thousand places you could be and doing all kinds of things, but you chose to be a part of what God is doing here. And so we just pray that already God has touched you and will continue to work in your life. Well, if you have your Bible, I invite you to turn with me to Ruth chapter 3, where if you're new, we're in a short mini-series on the book of Ruth, and we've come to Ruth chapter 3, where the title of the message is Ruth Proposes to Boaz. Ruth proposes to Boaz. Well, do you remember the day, if you're married, do you remember the day when either you were the one asking for someone's hand or you were the one who was being asked? And that is a big moment in a person's life. Well, when you come to Ruth chapter 3, let me tell you, it is a creative proposal. Because what you have in Ruth chapter 3 is you have a mother-in-law encouraging her daughter-in-law to propose to a man. And not only is she asking her to propose, but she's telling her to take a bath, to get perfumed up, to put on her most attractive clothes, to go at midnight or to go in the dark to a threshing floor and to lie down beside a man and to see what will happen. That is terrible advice. But that is exactly the advice Ruth gets from her mother-in-law, Naomi, when you come to Ruth chapter 3. Now, if you haven't been with us, I encourage you to get the message. You can listen to it probably on our app and get it and get caught up to speed. But when you get to the end of chapter 2, what happens is Ruth has been gleaning in the field. It just so happened, providentially, God is working in her life, leads Ruth to a field where the owner of the field happens to be a wealthy relative of the family. Not just a wealthy relative of the family, but he's a man that the Bible calls, it uses a term that's used periodically in the Bible of men who are, they're the real deal. The Hebrew term is Gibor Chayil. It is a worthy man. That means he's a man of wealth. He's a man of war. He's a man of wisdom. He's a man of worship. He is the package. And when you get down to the end of chapter 2, Ruth comes back from one day gleaning, just one day. Because you see, this man, Boaz, has told his workers in the field, leave her extra, make it easy on her. She comes back with nearly 50 pounds of barley from one day of gleaning. So you know something is happening there. And so we read this in Ruth chapter 2 and verse 19. Ruth chapter 2, verse 19. Where did you gather all this grain today? Naomi asked. Where did you work? May the Lord bless the one who helped you. So Ruth told her mother-in-law about the man in whose field she had worked, and she said, the man I worked with today is named Boaz. May the Lord bless him, Naomi told her daughter-in-law. He's showing his kindness to us as well as to your dead husband. That man is one of our closest relatives, one of our family redeemers. And as we make our way through Ruth chapter 3, and I'm going to make some comments and then we'll jump into the text, it's important for us to understand two concepts that God had initiated and established that play into how Ruth responds, what Naomi's thinking, what Boaz is thinking. The first one is the whole idea of a family redeemer. Remember, Naomi says, this man, Boaz, is one of our family redeemers. What does that mean? Well, back when the people of Israel moved into the promised land and they took the land was divided up tribe by tribe, family by family, and everybody was given an inheritance. And what God understood about human nature and understands about that today is that there's times when people lose their inheritance. I mean, there are some here in this room, and you've gone through a difficult financial time. Sometimes it's due to circumstances beyond our control. We try, we do our best, but then there's loss. Other times, people lose their inheritance. They encounter a situation where it's bankruptcy because of decisions that at the time maybe seemed like a good decision, but in retrospect, hindsight, you say that wasn't the best decision. Or sometimes it's just outright terrible decision-making where you have people, I've seen people who have gotten an inheritance and have burned it up. One guy I know burned up $250,000 snorting it up his nose. So it wasn't even just a bad decision, it was an awful, horrible decision as he did drugs. Today he's become a Christian, but that inheritance is gone. But in that day, what God was saying, because the land was sacred, what God was saying is, I don't want, and we hear something about the heart of God in this. What God is saying is, I don't want people to have to live out the remainder of their life as a loser. I don't want people to have experienced loss and then have to go through the rest of their life feeling as if somehow there's no way for recovery and that they're penalized the rest of their life. That in the heart of God, what God wants to do in your life and in my life is God is a redeemer. It is a part of his nature. He wants to redeem people from loss. That Jesus is called our redeemer. He redeems us from the curse. He redeems the loss that Adam incurred in the garden when man lost his dominion, when man lost the ability to walk with God. Jesus comes to redeem us that we might not experience loss in an ongoing manner. So the kinsman redeemer is this concept that God said if there's somebody in the family that's close by, he had it put into the law that relative could go in and redeem the land, redeem the person, could redeem a situation, could get justice. I mean, there's a variety of examples of that. You find it in Numbers 25. You find it in Leviticus 25 of how that redemption might work. Then there's a second principle, and it's the principle of levirate marriage. And so lever, the word from the Latin is means brother-in-law. And what would happen there is that if you had a family where a man got married and he died and there was no child that was produced, the brother-in-law would come and would marry the widow. And the first child produced to that union would carry on the dead man's name. Because what God is saying is not only does he not want people to experience loss, he also wants people cared for. And a widow in that day would not have anyone to care for her, and there would not be the safety nets that we would have today in our society. And not only that, but there's something in the heart of the Lord where he wants to do good generationally. It's a very interesting thing because we have a tendency in our instant society to think of the here and now. Everything is about us right now. But God, being eternal, obviously, has a long-term perspective, and he understands what happens in one generation for the good or the bad can affect the next generation and the generations subsequent to that. That not only is there something sacred about the land and the passing on of the inheritance, but there is equally something that's very spiritually significant about the legacy that passes of blessing from generation to generation. You find it, it's interesting, in Exodus chapter 34, that when Moses asked to see God pass by, and God says, no one can see my face and live, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you in a hollowed out point in the rock, I'm going to put my hand over you, I'm going to pass by, and I'll remove my hand as I pass by, and you'll be able to see the afterglow of my glory. And so as Moses is up there, God appears, and when God appears, you know, how does God choose to reveal himself? There is a voice that shouts out, the Lord gracious and compassionate, showing loving kindness to thousands upon thousands and generations. There's something about God that wants us to, he wants to bless the generations. And for every single one of us, it speaks to us about the importance of the legacy that we would leave. That you and I, the decisions that we make, the words that we speak, the way that we live, leaves a legacy for the good and the blessing or for the bad. I was reminded of that. Debbie and I were up in Minnesota in May, and we were each speaking at a different conference, and then I was going to speak at a church on that Sunday. And Debbie's family on her mom's side is originally from Minnesota. They're good old hearty Norwegians. And so Debbie got a call before we went up there, and it was from somebody who said, hey, we're a part of your mother's family, and we're a different part of the family. We've never met you, and we would like to meet you when you're coming up there. Our name is Bakken Bonnie, Debbie's mother. Her maiden name is Bakken, B-A-L-K-E-N. But these folks said their name was Bakken, B-A-K-K-E-N, you know, like the Bakken Oil Reserve. Like, I'm thinking, hey, this is priority. Even if you miss your conference, be good to get to know this family. Kind of patch things up, see if you can get us cut in. You know, I mean, so she... Anyway... So she meets with them, and they start telling a story. They tell a story about Debbie's family that we were not aware of. Basically, Bonnie's grandfather had a business and didn't know the Lord. And back in the late 1800s, he was short on money, and he decided to burn his business to the ground, collect the insurance, and then fled to California. How many know that's not a good thing? That's not a way to solve your problems. But maybe Naomi was advising him, but that's what he did. So he goes to California, and when he's in California, he winds up at a revival, and I believe it's the Azusa Street Revival. He ends up getting saved. Well, all of a sudden, you know, I mean, he's saved, and now he knows what he's done, and he knows he needs to make it right. And so what he does is he goes back to Minnesota, he admits what he has done, pays back the insurance company, settles everything. But the upshot of that is that out of that one decision by that person to say, first of all, I'm going to honor God, I'm going to begin living for God, I'm going to know God, suddenly now, and he's making that decision to make things right and to walk with God, now all of a sudden God begins to honor this individual by the name of Jacob Bakken. So that when you watch from that lineage, I mean, there's 15 plus descendants involved in ministry or have been involved in ministry, and I think there's more than that. It'd be close to 20 descendants that are involved in ministry and other things, but you watch. One man says, I'm going to live for God, I'm going to serve God, I'm going to love God, and it changes the generations. Which speaks to every single one of us about the kind of legacy. What kind of legacy are you leaving with the decisions that you're making, with the words that you're speaking, with the way that you're living your life? Because God is interested in, I believe the Lord is going to come back. I believe he's coming back soon. But if I'm not correct in the sense that he comes back in my lifetime, I mean, I want my children to be blessed, and I want my grandchildren to be blessed, and the way I live my life determines much of what God will do in their lives. It's not every man for himself. It's not you just do what you want and hope it all works out, and well, they'll just have to figure it out. No, in God's economy, God cares about the legacy that people leave. God cares about the decisions that people make. And God wants to give people a chance to know his redemption. All of that then functions as a backdrop. Though what we read in chapter 3 is not a Levirate marriage in the sense that Boaz is not the brother to Elimelech. What happens apparently in the Jewish society, in the Hebrew society, is that concept of Levirate marriage now extends to the extended family, and there is a responsibility that is embraced by them. And so that figures in to the whole story. With that being said, let's pick it up beginning in Ruth chapter 3 and verse 1. We're reading from the New Living Translation. The reason why is it reads just a little easier for you to get the sense of what's happening there. One day, Naomi said to Ruth, "My daughter, it's time that I found a permanent home for you. So let's not wait on God. Let's not begin praying. Let's not think through what God might be doing and trust in his providence," which we so obviously are seeing, because only about a month has passed since Ruth has been working in the field. Rather than waiting on God, rather than having learned something from chapter 1 where she and Elimelech took matters in their own hands and moved away from the house of bread and the provision of God and God's people, and it didn't work out good, and Elimelech died and the sons died. Rather than learn from that, here's Naomi, and she's at it again. She's going to take matters into her hands. She senses that God is working providentially, and she thinks because God is working providentially that she just can jump in the middle of it and make something happen. That's a dangerous thing for people to do. That we have to be careful that we understand, as Thomas Watson, the Puritan, said, that providence is the Christian's diary, not their Bible. You say, what does that mean? What it means is this: you don't determine what you're going to do in life based on what you think God is doing. You determine what you're going to do in life based on what God has said in his word. But Naomi is, she's interpreting the events. It happens to be correctly that God is working in she and Ruth's life, but now she's giving terrible advice. Look at it. Boaz is a close relative of ours, and he's been very kind by letting you gather grain with his young women. Tonight, he'll be winnowing barley at the threshing floor. Now, do as I tell you. Take a bath. Put on perfume. Dress in your nicest clothes. Then go to the threshing floor, but don't let Boaz see you until he has finished eating and drinking. We're going to read later that she's going at night. Be sure to notice where he lies down. Then go, uncover his feet, and lie down there. Now, let me just say this. Uncovering his feet, if it's already not like starting to feel a little steamy, uncovering his feet, that exact phrase is translated in Daniel chapter 10 and verse 6 as legs. So what we're talking about here is not some ancient, pleasant little custom the Jewish people had. And what you have here is a euphemistic way of like, oh, man, you know, like you're kind of embarrassed, so you're trying to say it in a nice way. That's what's happening here. What you have is you have Ruth being instructed by her mother-in-law to get herself all dolled up, to go at night, and to uncover Boaz's legs. And he'll tell you what to do. I mean, that's awful advice. And Ruth, I'll do everything you say. I mean, she is as naive as the day is long. And you just wonder, what in the world are you thinking? Because, I mean, honestly, Ruth going at night, she could be subject to wild animals attacking her. There's lions, there's bears. She's going up to a threshing floor, which is not in the town. It's going to be outside the town. It's going to be up on a hill. It's going to be a place where that can catch the wind, because as they're threshing the grain and then as they're winnowing the grain, they're going to be tossing the grain in the air and letting the wind blow through it so that it can remove the chaff. So it's outside the city. I mean, this is not in the city. She's going to be going to a threshing floor where there's going to be a lot of men. They're going to be working long hours. And at night, they're going to be doing the things that a group of guys are going to do in that setting and in that culture. As we're going to see, there's going to be alcohol that's present. So they're going to drink. They're going to be feeling very relaxed, very happy. She's going to show up there. She doesn't know that Boaz is going to be there. If he's not there and there's a bunch of young guys there and they've been drinking, and it's nighttime, and she shows up looking like she's there for a good time. That's a huge risk to her. It's a huge risk to her reputation. Word gets out in the town. Little town. Bethlehem's not very big. Did you hear what Ruth did? Can you believe what she did? I mean, things could go from bad to worse in a hurry. Not only that, it could damage Boaz's reputation. Here's a man who's known as a worthy man. Here's a man who's known as the best of men in Bethlehem. This is a man who is honored, but now all of a sudden there's a woman that is chasing him, and she's showing up, and she's doing this, and she's uncovering. I mean, he could charge her with immodesty or indecency. He could, at the very least, have his own reputation ruined. I mean, the whole thing is fraught with all kinds of difficulty. But again, here's Naomi, and she's thinking, you know, the end justifies the means. And that is never true for the child of God. What we read here, you can't look at the end of the book and say, well, it all worked out. If it all worked out, it's because of two things. Number one, because of God's providential goodness, his desire to do good. And number two, because Boaz is a worthy man. Remember that at the start of chapter 2? We saw that. Now, Boaz was a worthy man. He was a Gibor Hail. He was a man of valor. He was a warrior. He was a man of wealth. He was very rich. He was a man of wisdom. He had understanding, and he was a man of worship. This is a godly man. This is a good man. And were it not for him... And he, by the way, is really a type or a picture of what a redeemer is. He's a good redeemer. He's a worthy man. He's a picture in some ways of Jesus, our redeemer. And were it not for his kindness, his wisdom, his honor in redeeming this situation, the whole thing could have gone up in flames. So look at it in verse 6. So, she went down to the threshing floor that night and followed the instructions of her mother-in-law. After Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he lay down at the far end of the pile of grain and he went to sleep. Then Ruth came quietly and uncovered his legs and lay down. Around midnight, Boaz suddenly woke up and turned over. I mean, the whole thing is got a bit of comedy. I mean, you're like, you know, can you imagine? I mean, here's this older guy, and all of a sudden he wakes up, and then, you know, at the foot of his bed is this beautiful woman. I mean, and he says, surprised to find her lying at his feet, "Who are you?" And she says, "I am your servant Ruth. Spread the corner of your covering over me, for you are my family redeemer." Here's the way you understand it. Will you marry me? I mean, it's a crazy proposal. Well, the question is, what's he going to do? I mean, she shows up. She's asking for marriage. I mean, that's just not done. There's nothing. Some people say, well, you know, that was just a little custom. There's nothing customary about any of this. If it raises your eyebrows, you can be sure it raised the reader's eyebrows. But what I want to do is I want to give you, out of this, three principles regarding the behavior of a worthy person. Because you know what? God's desire is that every single one of us would be worthy in this sense, that we would be people of valor, that we'd be people of honor, that we'd be people of integrity, that we would be a worthy person. And here is Boaz, and he is that. And I see three things in the way he responds. Number one, a worthy person understands the importance of patience. A worthy person understands the importance of patience. Look at it in verse 10. "The Lord bless you, my daughter," Boaz exclaimed. I mean, the first thing he does, and I think this is wise. I mean, you're going to watch his wisdom through all of this. And honestly, your ability to walk in wisdom is only going to be as good as your ability to surround yourself with wise advisors. Because you can have advisors that are like Naomi, that are unwise, and though they could be well-meaning, they get you in trouble. Here is Boaz, and this man is wise. I mean, think of it this way. Imagine you're single, it's the middle of the night, and you wake up, you're disturbed, and you find yourself partially unclothed with a beautiful woman at the foot of your bed. Now, I mean, I realize for some of you, you're like, man, John, you're going to offend me. And I'm just telling you, it's in the Bible, okay? So if this offends you, you probably need to be offended more. But you know, this is crazy. I mean, what are you going to do? If you're in that situation, what are you going to do? Here's what Boaz does. I love this. "I want the Lord to bless you." I mean, that's like putting the brakes on immediately, right? I mean, that is Boaz's way of turning this whole thing around. He brings God into the situation. And he knows this: if God is going to bless Ruth, then he's got to treat her honorably, right? Listen, gals, if some guy has your best interest at heart, what he wants for you is he wants God to bless your life. Because I'm going to tell you, nothing is more valuable and more worthwhile in your life than the blessing of God, the hand of God on your life. So if some guy says, "I value you and I honor you," but he wants you to do things that would dishonor God and would in any way lessen God's hand and God's blessing on your life, then he does not love you and he does not honor you. If he's seeing you and seeing you as somebody that he wants to sleep with, he says, "Oh, I love you and I want to be with you," but translated means, "I'm not really sure I'm ready for commitment. You know, marriage, that's really a big deal. And so let's just sleep together. Let's just move in together." He doesn't have your best interest at heart. He's not a man of honor. Because a man of honor would say, "I want God to bless you." And so immediately he puts God into the equation, and that changes absolutely every aspect of the dynamic of the relationship. Just say to those who are dating that if you'll keep God at the center of the relationship, it will keep you from doing a lot of things that will diminish your relationship long term and will cause you a lot of heartache. Here's Boaz. He says, "You know what? I want the Lord to bless you. That's what I want." Now watch what he does, verse 10. "You are showing even more family loyalty now than you did before, for you have not gone after a younger man, whether rich or poor. Now don't worry about a thing, my daughter." And again, what he's doing is he is setting the parameters in their relationship. He's not advancing the relationship, and let me tell you why. Because he's patient. Watch what he says here. "Now, don't worry about a thing, my daughter. I will do what is necessary, for everyone in town knows you're a virtuous, if not naive, woman. But while it's true that I'm one of your family redeemers, there's another man who is more closely related to you than I am. Do you know what he's saying? He's not going to make the mistake that Naomi makes of saying, well, providentially, it seems like it's all coming together. Man, you ended up in my field, and now you're at my grain pile. Wow. It's nighttime. You look awesome. He's not going there. He's saying, I want God to bless you, and I also want God to bless me. And I want God to work in this situation. And so the fact of the matter is, I understand. He's being kind to her. He's saying, I understand why you're here. I get what you're wanting in terms of relationship. Is he interested? Absolutely, he's interested. But he's not so interested in getting Ruth as his wife that he's willing to set aside God's will for his life. It gets a lot of people in trouble. In such a hurry to get a spouse or to get a mate or to get that financial deal to go through or to get this or to get that, that they're willing to set aside God's will, thinking that somehow if they compromise God's will, it's going to work out and bring about the end result that God would have desired anyway. Boaz isn't going to have any of that. Boaz says, listen, it's true, I understand why you're here. I am a kinsman redeemer, and if you're wondering if I have any interest in a relationship with you, I do. But I'm not going to get ahead of God, and nor am I going to ask or seek something in my own life that is not God's will. There's somebody who is ahead of me. There's another kinsman redeemer. There is a prescribed order. There's a way this is supposed to work. And I'm going to trust God to work through those things. And if it's meant to be, it will happen. This is a man who understands that patience ultimately is about others. That when a person's impatient, it's about themselves. I mean, you get that. I mean, you get impatient in a line or at a light or whatever situations any of us could find ourselves being impatient. Always it's about us. We're not thinking of the people in front of us. We're not thinking of the people around us. We're not thinking of where they've been, what their day's been like, what's been going on in their life. Because the minute you and I begin to think about others, we suddenly find ourselves being a whole lot more patient with the things that could have been irritating us before, right? When you suddenly think, you know what? That person in the line, maybe they're conversing there, and maybe there's a conversation because this person's very lonely. And maybe they're going to go home and they're not going to have anybody to talk to. And this is the one time they get social interaction. Or maybe they're a little slow because they've encountered some kind of physical disability along the way that has caused them. Or maybe there's issues there that you don't understand. And instantly when we start to think about other people, it makes us patient. And when we desire God's blessing, it makes us willing to wait. And that's why the writer of the Psalm 37 in verse 7 says this, be still in the presence of the Lord. Wait patiently for him to act. Listen, God's desire is to do good to you. God's desire is that nobody live life as a loser. God's desire is to see you live the kind of life that allows him to not only bless you, but bless those after you, that you live a life that has a legacy to it. That's God's desire. And if you and I want to see God work in that way in our life, then we have to be patient enough to allow him to act. Isaiah 30 in verse 18, yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. Therefore, he will rise up to show you compassion. In other words, the heart of God is to do good to you. The heart of God is to help you, is to bless you. One translation says he rises to show you compassion. He gets excited about it. He stands up. It's like, he's like, oh, here's a chance for me to do good in their life. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all who wait for him. If you wait on God, you'll never be sorry. If you put God first, you'll never be sorry. If you say, God, I want your blessing and your will and your way more than I want my own way, you'll never be sorry. You will always be blessed. The second thing about a worthy person understands the value of integrity. I mean, what that is being on the inside what they are on the outside, or vice versa, being on the outside what they are on the inside. Of being a person who's righteous, being a person who treats people right. Watch what happens here in verse 13. Stay here tonight, and in the morning I will talk to him. If he's willing to redeem you, very well, let him marry you. That's such an interesting idea that here's Boaz. Does he want to get married? Yes. Does he want to marry Ruth? Yes. But not if it's not God's will. He wants God's will more than he wants his own way. And he's saying, listen, I will accept what the Lord gives, and I will accept what he withholds. Because my trust is in the one who I know wants to do the best for me. I mean, this is a man of faith, and this is the kind of life God blesses. No wonder he's a man of wisdom. No wonder he's a man of war and valor. No wonder he's a man of wealth. No wonder he's a man of worship. This is the kind of life God blesses. He says, listen, I want what God wants in my life. He says, now lie down here until morning. You say, what's that about? He understands if she goes out at night, it's not going to go well for her potentially. If there's a lion, which lions were common in that day and around that area, if you go there to the Holy Land today, you see all these rocky areas, all these caves where lions could be. You remember David when he's a shepherd in Bethlehem, who is a descendant, a great-grandson of Ruth. When he's out there watching the sheep. He kills a lion, he kills a bear. He does it in preparation for killing Goliath. So, I mean, it's a very genuine, a very real threat. So Ruth lay at Boaz's feet until the morning, but she got up before it was light enough for people to recognize each other. For Boaz had said, no one must know that a woman was here at the threshing floor. In other words, this man of honor is wanting to honor her reputation. He's wanting to make sure that as much as possible, she's put him in a bad place, but he's not going to berate her for that. He's saying, listen, you shouldn't have come here. It's not good. People don't need to. This is not a good situation. We need to get out of this as gracefully and as carefully as we can. So when it's the light's just starting to come up, you need to jet out of here. And again, he cares about her because he's a man of integrity, and he's not going to do anything that's going to damage her reputation. Ladies, Boaz is the template for the man you want to marry. Number three, a worthy person understands the necessity of loving extended family. A worthy person understands the necessity. You want to make your marriage work, you got to love the in-laws. Not just tolerate them, not just put up with them. You have to love them. You know, Debbie and I, when we give wedding cards to people, we have a card, and the inside says this. It says, may you learn to love your in-laws. And here's the front of the card. So there are the in-laws. You know, at times people say, well, you know, I really love her, I really love him, but I'm just not so crazy about the family. Bad idea. Don't get married. You are marrying the family. You say, no, I'm just marrying them. No. You are marrying the mom, the dad. You're marrying the irritating whoever is in there. And every family has them. You know your family has them. So what's your deal? I mean, come on. There's no family that doesn't have, you know, the idiosyncrasies and the uniquenesses. Well, you say, yeah, that's true, but you don't know what they're like. And I would just say to you, when you read this, they couldn't be any worse than Naomi. I mean, she is the mother-in-law from Bethlehem. Okay. I mean, can you imagine her? She's a piece of work. I mean, she is one of these constantly prodding, got a great plan for everybody's life, and going to tell everybody else what to do. And a lot of times it's not wise. And then when it doesn't go right, she's going to blame God and everybody else. I mean, she is something. But you know what you find here? You find Boaz, this mighty man of valor. You find him accepting Naomi's weaknesses and doing it graciously and kindly because, again, this is a mighty man of valor. And a mighty man of valor takes responsibility and he takes ownership and he does it in a gracious way. He doesn't walk in and say, well, okay, you know, Ruth, I'm interested in you, but your mother-in-law, she's a piece of work and... You know, so I'm going to help you, and here's what I'm going to... He doesn't do that. In fact, you wouldn't even realize he was doing it unless you knew he was doing it. Watch it in verse 15. Then Boaz said to her, bring your cloak and spread it out. And he measured 6 scoops of barley into the cloak and placed it on her back. Now, 6 scoops is about 90 pounds. So, I mean, it's really kind of comical. It's like, I'm going to send your mother-in-law a present. Here, lean over. And he places 90 pounds, like, on her. And you have to believe Ruth's thinking, I would have preferred a diamond ring. I mean, you know, this is kind of the engagement ring. This is like saying, I'm in, I'm on. If this can work out, if the Lord's in this, I'll fulfill it. And then he returns to town. So, I mean, a man does have his limits. I mean, he lets her carry it back. The verse 16, the whole thing is kind of interesting. When Ruth went back to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, what happened, my daughter? And Ruth told Naomi everything Boaz had done for her, and she added, he gave me these 6 scoops of barley. And he said, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. You know what he's saying? Musicians, you can come up on the platform. What he's saying to her is this. He's saying, Naomi, I understand what you're trying to do here, but it really needs to be done in the right way. And it needs to be done in the will of God and in the way that God would work. And with the blessing of God, and Naomi, you're worried about being cared for. You're worried about provision. You're worried about who's going to take care of you. And Naomi, I just want you to know, because he's not guaranteed he's marrying Ruth. Yeah, there's somebody in front of him who may choose to say, I want to marry her. But he's saying, listen, Naomi, it's going to be okay. You're going to be taken care of. And I get why you've done all of this, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but he expresses his disagreement with kindness by doing something kind, that, Naomi, there's another way this could work. And you can set your heart at ease. You can rest in the providential care of God to take care of you. You can trust God. He's good. He does good. You say, well, how did you get all of that out of there? Oh, because of what she says. Remember at the start? Naomi's like, well, you know, we've been here in town a couple months, and you're not getting any younger. Time to get you out there get you married off. We're going to do this and this and this, and it's an awful plan. It's a terrible plan. It's an unwise plan, but she's of the school. You know, if God's not moving fast enough, just get out in front and make it happen. And Boaz is saying, that's not how we're going to play. And it's like Naomi gets it, and she says to Ruth, this from the woman who was saying, hurry, hurry, hurry. And now she says, just be patient, my daughter. Wait until we hear what happens. Slow down. Let's be patient. Let's see what happens. The man won't rest until he settled things today. And remember, Jesus, Boaz, is a type of Christ. He won't rest till he's settled things. You go to him, and he won't rest until he's settled things. You go to him, and he's going to be generous with you. You can trust him. You don't need to worry, because he'll do everything that needs to be done. Do you get that imagery there? It's beautiful. It's powerful. You can rest in the arms of a God who will treat you honorably, who will act towards you generously, and who will not rest till you get justice. Beautiful story of God's care, not just for two widows, but for every single person sitting in this room today. God cares for you. You may have thought that unless you took matters into your own hands, it wasn't going to happen. Stop. There's a Redeemer. He's more generous and more active and more gracious than you can possibly imagine. Let's pray.